Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday. Yay, it's Friday, May 6, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everybody. We finally made it, and spring is fully sprung here. It is a sunny 58 degrees and beautiful spring morning here in upstate New York. Mother's Day weekend, so don't forget, I have lots of stuff to do after the show today. Of course, my mother's coming to visit, so I have to get some cleaning done. So where do we leave off? Yesterday, we titled the show, Reanimator, Donate Your Body to Mad Science and Eyeball, Google Eyeball Injections. Yeah, we talked about some pretty insane things. What happens to your body after you die and you donate it to science? Don't donate your body to science. Not if they're going to try to do things like bring you back from the dead. I don't know. You know, that seems to be a theme on this show. And it'd be great to have push-button cures for everything, but right now, they haven't quite perfected things, and anybody who is stepping up for these get-healthy, quick cures, cure your aging, and forever be 25 cures isn't going to happen, guys. We are the guinea pigs, and you know, there may be a little bit of benefit somewhere. Maybe you'll get some improvement somewhere. There's a good chance that it's not going to be, and that the experiment that you're a part of is a bust, if not an outright failure. And I don't think any of us deserve that. I mean, we should be getting the same, if not better, than everybody else. And there is absolutely no way that I know I want to step up and be made a Frankenstein monster. So we can now inject stem cells into different body parts. This is kind of what they're working with now and rejuvenating this, that, and the other thing. I just saw one last night. Speaking of the last story we did yesterday about injecting Google's new contact lens into your eyeball, Japanese scientists have now, again, skin cells that they've turned into stem cells. They have used skin cells to restore vision in a patient for the very first time. More eyeball tests. Japanese scientists have reported the first successful skin-to-eye stem cell transplant in humans, where stem cells derived from a patient's skin were transplanted into her eye and partially restored lost vision. Now, like I said yesterday, stem cells, I think out of all the technologies, stem cells are probably, in my eyes, some of the most promising. I would even, if I was desperate and dying, I think I would even probably step up for a stem cell treatment that they've created from my own cells if they gave me that option. I might actually be a part of the study, especially if it was my own cells, but not any type of nanobot thing, not any type of synthetic thing, not any type of, and we'll look at, you know, this, some of this other insane stuff that they're working on, manipulating all of our genes and then injecting them back in. That's not going to happen, at least to me. But yeah, so they've restored vision now as well. 70-year-old woman was diagnosed with age-related macular degeneration, of course, a leading cause of vision impairment in older people and animals. I think my 18-year-old cat is starting to get some macular degeneration. Can see it in his eyes, and at night, sometimes he has a lot of trouble differentiating between which are lumps in the blanket and which are monsters. And I know the poor little guy is having trouble seeing. Anyway, the 70-year-old woman received the experimental treatment back in 2014 as part of a pilot study. And now, closing in on 2 years after this transplant took place, the scientists are sharing their results. The research took a small piece of skin from her arm, about 4 millimeters in diameter, and modified its cells, effectively reprogramming them into induced pluripotent cells, the iPSC cells, right? Those are the ones that we've talked about. The pluripotent stem cells have the ability to differentiate into almost any type of tissue within the body, which is why skin cells taken from an arm can be repurposed into retinal tissue or lung or spine or, you know, how a myriad of other things. I think we also saw they did sperm and egg and heart and brain cells. I mean, this really is cutting edge. And if they can get a handle on this technology and prevent, we saw there was the pluripotent and then the multipotent cells. The multipotent cells were the ones that they were getting from the embryonic stem cells. They also created some, I'm trying to remember, we looked at that yesterday. They created multipotent out of something else. But the problem with the multipotent is that they can go rogue and overproduce, creating cancerous tumors and things. And so they've kind of put a kibosh on those. But these pluripotent cells that they can make out of skin cells don't seem to go awry like that. So honestly, if they can get a handle on exactly how this works and do lots of different tests, and again, like I said, stepping up for your own stem cells, I don't think I'd have a problem with, because at least it would be part of my body. It would be like them growing me an organ, which they have done also with stem cells that they've gotten from skin. They were growing organs on scaffolds made out of a simple sugar base. And I think now even we saw they had stem cell 3D printers. That was a few weeks ago, where it's like a pen 3D printer and they can literally reprint cartilage and things. How long is it going to be before they're reprinting organs or whatever? I mean, the barbaric surgeries and things of the past, you know, Dr. McCoy used to laugh about 20th century medicine, about how barbaric it was since they had the tricorder. You know, it could actually become that one day. Stem cells could be that promise. But, you know, some of this other zombie apocalypse stuff, I don't know. You know, I'm going to go back. That injecting brain dead patients' brains with stem cells, all right, I can see why they want to do it. There is a lot of mystery about what actually constitutes brain death. I mean, obviously, if your bodily functions are no longer functioning and the machine is doing everything for you, means that your body, I mean, if you were unplugged, you wouldn't be able to survive. But on the other hand, there is also been stories of people waking up after 20 years and, you know, they thought that they were gone. Like, how is that even possible? I just, it's something really difficult to wrap your head around. I mean, I guess, like I said yesterday, these people, if they donated their bodies to science or whatever, well, whatever they do with you after the fact, I guess you don't have a lot of say in, according to that story we read yesterday. But on the other hand, if you didn't sign up for this and then they're experimenting on you without your consent, regardless of whether or not you're clinically dead, there's some real ethical problems there. Because like I said, what if they wake up? And I mean, right, we want them to wake up, but what if they wake up and they're not quite the same? What if they have a bloodlust? You know, what if they walk around screaming brains? What are we going to do then? You know, it's disturbing. I know that they've been messing around with reducing the body temperature, like in the case of Gabby Giffords when she got shot. You know, her husband was the Gil Giffords, I think his name was, the guy that just spent the longest amount of time up on the space shuttle. He's a NASA guy. And one of the things that they were experimenting with at NASA and some of the black ops for long-range space travel was suspended animation. And there were some mainstream videos about that a few years ago. Pigmine had them that we played. They had been working on suspended animation, and they discovered that one of the ways you could do that was by lowering the body temperature below a certain point. So you go into like a hibernation mode, just like frogs or, you know, any other little creature that hibernates for the winter. you go into low power consumption mode, right? So you don't need food, really. You keep your fat stores your body uses. You don't really need water because you're in conservation mode. And the brain goes into low power mode, sleep mode, just like your computer. And potentially you could last a lot longer that way. They've been messing around with things such as that as far as being able to turn the brain on and off. And, you know, we discussed, too, consciousness itself. The way that our brain functions is on different frequencies. And when we're wide awake, we're in that high band frequency. When we are in an altered state, our frequency's jacked down. And when we're sleeping in REM and then deep sleep, we're way in low numbers. And makes a lot of sense. The whole world is analog. And we are all, be it, an analog device with some biological components to it that walk around and think and talk, unlike some of the other components. But I really got off track. What was I talking about? So they were messing around with the brain and Gabby Giffords. So that was how Gabby Giffords actually walked away from getting shot in the head and not having lots of brain damage. They really quickly got her into one of those chill baths. I don't know what they call them, but they did it also with one of the Buffalo Bills here who had brain injury, major spinal cord injury, and they dropped his body temperature. And I don't know if they literally take your blood out, cool it, and put it back in, or if they just drop you down into really cool, a cool solution that cools the blood down. I wouldn't think, though, that that would happen too fast, so they probably would have to take it out and put it in. But save both of them by just reducing the temperature. And they've come out of, you know, they even put people into induced comas to help their brain heal. But people have come out of long-term brain injury years later and been like, what happened? You know, my aunt, she's got to be gone now. I don't remember her name. It wasn't Aunt Shirley. I don't remember which aunt it was. She was the one that read tea leaves. I remember her very vaguely when I was little, but she caused some ruckus in the family because she was at my parents' house when I was a kid. There was some party or something, and my cousin was there. And she took my cousin into the bedroom, closed the door, wanted to do a reading for him, and he came out all white as a sheet. And within the next 3 days, he had had a really tragic car accident and was dead. And nobody knows what, oh my God, I can't remember her name. Nobody knows what my aunt told him, but they assume that she told him that he better say his goodbyes over the next couple days. But she ended up getting very sick years later, and she was in a coma for probably 15, 20 years maybe. And they had her on the machines. And one day, she just woke up. She just woke up, and she didn't live too long after that. But nobody ever expected her to wake up. So I don't know. Like I said, them injecting stem cells into brains to see what's going to happen and whether or not you can rejuvenate a damaged brain. I have bad feelings about this because stem cell technology is moving very quickly. It's been very successful. And even though these brains have been sleeping, and you don't know what got them to that point, so they didn't give us any type of criteria that they were looking, so you have to make sure that they weren't deprived of oxygen, you have to make sure that there weren't any like dents in the head, so there'd be major damage to an area of the brain, obviously. You don't want a brain that's already damaged, just one that maybe is out, that isn't functioning properly. I don't know. You guys can tell that that's been bothering me. I actually dreamed about it last night. All right, let's get back to these eyeball stem cell transplants. So once these cells were coaxed into developing retinal pigment epithelium, which are the RPEs, they were cultured in a lab to grow into an ultra-thin sheet, which was then transplanted behind the retina of the patient. I'm very pleased to say that there were no complications with the transplant surgery, says Michio Tikoishi from the Riken Center for Developmental Biology in 2014. However, this is only the first step for use of the iPSC in regenerative medicine. I have renewed my resolve to continue foraging ahead until this treatment becomes available to many patients. While it is definitely still early for this experimental procedure, remember, all of this stuff that we talk about, every single bit of it is experimental, and they're already doing this stuff on humans, okay? Ethics 101, and we are stepping up for it. When people step up and sign up for a clinical trial, they are giving their consent to this, something that wasn't seen as ethically sound before, to be doing live experiments on humans. But this is all experimental. So even though we get these quote-unquote case studies that come out that say, look at the wonderful results we had, I bet you there's 100 experiments that weren't so rosy as the one that got on paper. Anyway, while this is definitely still early days for this experimental procedure, the signs so far are promising. The team held off on reporting the results until now to monitor the patient's progress. Well, that was smart. Engage how successfully the modified cells lasted, but they just reported that the transplanted cells survived without any adverse events for over a year, resulting in slightly improved vision for the patient. The transplanted RPE sheet survived well without any findings or indications of immune rejections or adverse unexpected proliferation for 1.5 years, achieving our primary purpose of this pilot study. And that's the one thing that's interesting. With the stem cells being made with your own skin cells, rejection is very low. That's the one thing you worry about doing any type of transplant is, you want to talk about like horribly horrifying. Back two, three years ago, there was that woman who was the friend of the other woman who had the chimp as a pet. Remember that? And the chimp freaked out and literally ripped the woman's face off. And I mean, that was probably one of the most disturbing, and it was her friend to boot, and the chimp just went insane and nobody really knows what happened. But ripped her face off. Now, of course, the woman who owned the chimp was extremely sorry. She didn't want to put the chimp down. The other woman decided she was going to sue, I believe. And she was, I'm trying to remember if she was one of the first for the face transplant. And I remember when they first did it, it was quite a success. I saw a story yesterday, after a few years now gone by, her body is starting to reject her face transplant. Now talk about horrifying. I mean, you went through it the first time. It was unbelievably horrifying. And now you're getting used to, at least you got a face back. Though it wasn't that pretty, you got a face back, and now your body's rejecting it. See, and that's what happens when it's not yours. Though, actually, come to think of it, I remember back, it had to be a year ago, Pigman had a video about 3D printed face transplants. So I don't know, maybe she'll be a candidate for one of these newer technologies. Anyway, back to this eyeball stem cell. While it is not a complete restoration of the patient's vision, a study shows a significant step forward in the use of induced pluripotent stem cells, which scientists think might be able to be used on a range of illnesses, as well as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, ding, ding, brain stem cells. That is what they also said in the study about reanimating brain dead yesterday, was that, of course, they wanted to see how much repair it could do in the brain, and not just for vision problems. A number of other studies are also showing positive results in restoring sight with stem cell treatments. Earlier in the year, researchers in China and the U.S. were able to improve the vision of babies with cataracts by manipulating protein levels in stem cells. Even more remarkably, a woman in Baltimore who was blind for more than 5 years had some of her vision restored after stem cells were extracted from her bone marrow and injected into her eyes. And while many questions remain about this particular treatment, there is no denying that stem cell research is a hugely exciting field. These findings were presented at the 2016 meeting of the Association for Research in Vision and Ophthalmology in Seattle. So, You know, stem cells really, to me, look like they're where we should be putting our bets, at least for the near future, for those of us who want to live forever. I absolutely would take a stem cell injection if I had some sort of major debilitating disease that was going to take me out. I think I would probably go for that. But what I wouldn't go for, and this is where we ended the last two shows, and I want to get through the story. And you know, hold on. I had to do another full reboot before I went to bed last night, and my Skype isn't loaded here. But let's see if I can get Skype to open. Maybe we can watch the video that goes along with this. Oh, let me log in. Oh, thank goodness it's Friday. This has been such a long week. All right. Oh, no, I just put the wrong password in. Hold on, it's early. I want to get through this story, and it's actually pretty short, but about the Google Bionic injectable contact lens. Because, I mean, if they're fixing vision with your own stem cells, and then Google is patenting some bionic contact lens where they replace your own lens, I think I'd rather take my stem cells. Well, I guess just... excuse me. I had to sneeze there for a second. Yeah, I think I would definitely take my stem cells over a Google eye implant any day of the week. All right, let's get to the story. Google patents device that you inject into your eyeball. Forget laser surgery. Like I said, I was already skeeved out by LASIK eyeball lasers, and let alone a needle with a little Google smart lens that replaces my biological lens. If Google has any say in it, we'll soon be injecting devices into our eyes to help us improve our vision. Up next, in terrifying things I don't want to ever have done, Google has filed a patent for vision-correcting electronic devices that are injected directly into your eye. And as we've seen now, we have had Samsung announce Samsung announced the camera contact lens, and Sony announced the video recording and playback contact lens. Google has gone a step farther, and they're going to do injectable lenses that have wireless antennas on them and everything. How long is it going to be before you can see an infrared, ultraviolet, record, and send with the blink of an eye with augmented reality internet as well? I don't think it's going to be too long. I think that's what the whole end result of this is going to be. This device, Forbes reports, is designed to help focus the light onto the retina, resulting in correction of poor vision. It will contain its own storage, radio, and lenses, and will apparently be powered wirelessly from the harvesting energy antennas, and presumably you won't need aerial antennas sticking out of your eyeball. And Google would not comment on this, but they have filed a patent, and of course it's no guarantee. All right, so let's listen to Brian Tong do a story. Hopefully he doesn't just read this little blurb. There's a video. I wanted to watch this yesterday, and we didn't get a chance. So I'm hoping.
You turn that.
I'm hoping we got a commercial first. Thanks. And guess what? It's 30 whole seconds long. So while we're doing that, let's take a look at the Google patent. The Google patents, and there are pictures of eyeballs, and it is right off the United States Patent Office website. Looks like it's pretty legit, guys. All right, 4, 3, 2, 1, blast off. Here we go.
What's up? Brian Tong here with everything Google we can pack inside of a show. Now, we've heard about Google's prototype smart contact lens that can measure glucose levels for people with diabetes. It still hasn't hit the market, but Google is not stopping there. A new patent filing by the Big G reveals they're working on a vision-correcting electronic device that needs to be injected directly into your eye. That's right, your eyeball. Now, the device would be injected in fluid and then solidifies once it's in the eye. The goal is to cure short-sightedness by removing someone's inferior biological lens and replacing it with a motorized one. The new electronic lens would help in the process of focusing light on the eye's retina. Now, the device will have storage, sensors, a radio, battery, and electronic lens, and it gets power wirelessly from an energy harvesting antenna. Crazy. Now, it's all fascinating stuff, and we'll be following this to see if this patent ever really becomes a reality. It's not nearly as impressive, but still impressive new tech from LG is bringing a display panel with an integrated fingerprint reader. That means no more physical buttons for a fingerprint scanner.
We don't care about. Hold on. Yeah, fingerprint scanners are just so yesterday. So, yeah, you know, for those short-sighted people, those nearsighted people with inferior biological lenses like me, Google will have a cure for that one. So step right up. In another story, and we touched on this last week, Microsoft, as well as some of the other tech vendors, are experimenting with DNA storage, and you can get up to, I believe we read, a zettabyte, a billion terabytes, into a gram of DNA, and it can keep data safe for thousands, if not millions, of years. I mean, what on earth is tomorrow going to look like? Chemists have now developed the world's tiniest thermometer out of DNA. Now, we're talking about biosensors. This is going to be another step forward in biosensors. It is 20,000 times thinner than a human hair. Scientists around the world are constantly cooking up new and better ways to develop nanotechnologies that can detect anything from breast cancers to building better touchscreens. Yeah. Breast cancer touchscreen, you know, was six of one, half dozen of the other. I mean, that's what it's come down to. We have all just become little electronic components that they're mixing and matching and making new stuff out of. I mean, DNA is no longer separate as a biological entity. They have all these little applications now that they can program with, CRISPR being one, and there were a couple other apps, and now there's some new brain app too where they can reprogram some stuff. You know, this is getting to a place where, you know, the next couple generations of life are probably not going to be on the same 1.0 level that we were born with. Says there's one big problem with working on such a small scale, though. It is nearly impossible to monitor how temperatures rise and fall within these structures because the normal tools are just too big for the job. Well, with this in mind, researchers in Canada have created the world's tiniest programmable thermometer made out of actual DNA. The new device is 20,000 times smaller than a human hair, and according to the University of Montreal team, this new device was inspired by a 60-year-old discovery that DNA molecules unfold when heated to a certain temperature. Could this be the basis of a new tiny thermometer technology? Well, in recent years, biochemists also discovered that biomolecules such as proteins or RNAs are employed as nanometers in living organisms and report temperature variation by folding or unfolding. Inspired by those natural nanothermometers, which are typically 20,000 times smaller than a human hair, we have created various DNA structures that can fold and unfold. Since DNA consists of four nucleotides, let's say it, what are they? C, T-A-G. The team was able to design a mechanism that would force the molecule to fold or unfold at a given temperature, which is very rudimentary. But it is more of a temperature signaling device. By adding optical reporters to these DNA structures, we can therefore create 5-nanometer-wide thermometers that produce an easily detectable signal as a function of temperature. The new thermometer will hopefully allow researchers to add a slew of questions that have gone unanswered for years, which as to whether or not the human body runs hotter than 37 degrees Celsius on a nanoscale, or if naturally occurring nanomachines overheat when functioning at a high rate. The team is now working to improve their tiny DNA thermometer to incorporate it into new electronic devices. A DNA thermometer they are going to integrate into electronic devices. How nice is that? And yeah, you know, they're like, well, do these little nanomachines overheat? I'm going to tell you, yes. Temperature is one of the big control systems in biological organisms. I was just having this discussion with my family the other day at dinner about how temperature not only helps regulate your metabolism and things of that nature, but temperature also helps protect your body when you're sick, obviously with a fever and things like that. And I know in myself, my internal clock, if I have my alarm set for 9 and I set my internal alarm for 9 in my brain, you know, you can do that. You can say, I need to be up at 9 o'clock. I have to be up at 9 o'clock. And if you do that, your eyes will go bink at 9 o'clock if you've trained yourself. You know, it takes a little bit of training, but you can definitely train your internal clock, especially if your ears are the type that turn off and don't hear an alarm. But what happens to me is when my internal clock is about ready to go off, one thing I cannot sleep through is being hot and sweaty. It just doesn't happen. If I am hot and uncomfortable, there is no sleeping for me. And so what happens when my internal clock alarm goes off? I get really hot, and it happens every single time. It's like all of a sudden my body temperature cranks up a good 2-3 degrees, whoop, and I'm like, whew, I got to kick off the blankets, whew, oh my goodness, I got to turn on the fan, and I'm so uncomfortable, I got to get up. And then I look at the clock, and I was like, oh, look, it's exactly 9 o'clock, and it never fails me. So I'm going to guess that they're going to find out that, yeah, overheating does occur, as does supercooling. And that is just through the body's own mechanisms. Here's another little one. This one came out of phys.org called Little Ants. Capital A-N-T is an acronym. Little Ants. Researchers build the world's tiniest engine. Researchers have developed the world's tiniest engine, just a few billionths of a meter in size, which uses light to power itself. Yeah, light is an energy source. It's almost like a plant now, isn't it? And the nanoscale engine developed by researchers at the University of Cambridge could form the basis for future nanomachines that can navigate water, sense the environment around them, or even enter living cells to fight disease. Ding, 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 da-ding, da-ding, ding. Little nanomachines for your cells. This prototype device made of tiny charged particles of gold, nanoparticles, are bound together with temperature-responsive polymers in the form of a gel. And when the nano engine is heated to a certain temperature with a laser, it stores large amounts of elastic energy at a fraction of a second as the polymer coatings expel all the water from the gel and collapse. This has the effect of forcing the gold nanoparticles to bind together into tight clusters, but when the device is cooled, the polymers then take on water and expand, and the gold nanoparticles are strongly and quickly pushed apart like a spring. Sprawing says it's like an explosion, a nanoparticle explosion, says Dr. Tao Ding from Cambridge's Cavendish Laboratory and the paper's first author. We have hundreds of gold balls flying apart in a millionth of a second when water molecules inflate the polymers around them. Wow. Sounds like something I really want inside my cells. See, this is the stuff I'm talking about. So we have stem cells, eyeball stem cells, your own stem cells that are coaxed into eyeball stem cells, put into your eyeball and fix your vision. That's one thing. Then we have little ants, these little tiniest engines made out of gold nanoparticles and gel that have a high-powered laser shot into them to suck out all the water that then are put into a cell and explode in a millionth of a second, sending gold nanoballs flying everywhere. You know, this is more mad science stuff. Don't step up for this. This would not be one that I'd be volunteering for. Says we know that light can heat up water to power steam engines. Yeah, just like a nuclear reactor. That's what we're doing. We're heating water to power steam. But now we can use light to power a piston engine at a nanoscale. Nanomachines have long been a dream of scientists like Eric Drexler. And the public alike. Well, not my public. But since ways to actually make them move have yet to be developed, they have remained in the realm of science fiction. Well, they also had those little DNA nanobots that they were doing locomotion with. I had a story on that. Oh, a couple weeks ago, back in 92, I think they were already experimenting with locomotion with little DNA nanobots. The new method developed by Cambridge researchers is incredibly simple, and it can be extremely fast and exert very large forces. The forces exerted by these tiny devices are several orders of magnitude larger than those for any other previous device, with a force weight nearly 100 times better than any motor or muscle. And it's such at a tiny scale. The team, of course, is working with Cambridge Enterprises, the university's commercialized arm. Like I said, sprinkle in money and then spin it off to be its own little mini startup. They're also working with several other companies with the aim of commercializing this technology for microfluidic bio applications. The research suggests how to turn the van der Waals energy, the attraction between the atoms and the molecules, into elastic energy of polymers and release it very quickly. This whole process is like a nano spring, and the smart part here is that we use van der Waals attraction of heavy metal particles to set the springs and water molecules to release them, which is very reversible and reproducible. So there you go. That is the new ants technology for little gold nano robotic engines that may someday be able to enter living tissue to fight disease. And it's being commercialized, so put on a seatbelt. All right, so we're going to take a little bit of a look. I don't think we're going to dig in too deep today because it's Friday. It was a long week. And nobody's brain wants to work too hard on a Friday morning, especially with a nice spring weekend coming. But we're going to take a look at another place where they've been dumping a lot of research lately, and that has been the Human Microbiome Project. We touched on the microbiome quite extensively 6+ months ago. We took a lot of time on it and kind of looked at some of the different things that they've discovered already, and we know just from our own research that the gut microbiota is very important, and it's an ecosystem of living organisms in your intestines that are very important to your health, and not just to your digestive health, but also to your mental health, right? We found out there's a direct connect between the gut and the brain, and it can influence your moods and your brain chemical production. And what's very disturbing is that now they're dumping tons of commercialized money, and DARPA's jumped into the game, and we got all these research laboratories now that are working on cracking the microbiome. The Human Microbiome Project was a United States National Institute of Health initiative. Ding, ding, again, National Institute of Health right in the middle of all this. And it was an initiative, which I did not realize, with the goal of identifying and characterizing the microorganisms which are found in association with both healthy and diseased humans, launched in 2008. It was a 5-year project best characterized as a feasibility study and had a total budget of $115 million. The ultimate goal of this and similar National Institute of Health-sponsored microbiome projects was to test how changes in the human microbiome are associated with human health or disease. This topic is currently not well understood, but don't worry about it because there's tons of money going into it right now. The more important components of the microbiome project were culture-independent methods of microbial community characterization, such as metagenomics, which provides a broad genetic perspective on a single microbial community, as well as extensive whole genome sequencing, which provides a deep genetic perspective on certain aspects of a given community. The latter served as reference genome sequences. 3,000 or such sequences of individual bacteria isolates are currently planned for comparison purposes. The microbiology of five sites was emphasized. They watched a TED Talk last week on this very thing. They have now been doing some real time. One of the researchers' daughters was born, and they did a 2.5-year daily sampling of all of the different bacterial colonies on the child's body, and then put them into a database and map them to show the development from newborn to a quote-unquote adult bodily microbiome community. And there are five different places where different bacterias live that all then not only interact, but they have wars and everything on your body. It's insane. You have, of course, your oral microbiome. And I was reading, too, when you drink alcohol or you eat certain foods or you smoke or you put anything into your mouth, that potentially can change that microbiota within your mouth. And if there is too much of a change of that microbiota... What was I just reading the other day? There's some cancer that they have now tied to a certain bacteria in the mouth. Everyone with this one kind of cancer has this bacteria in their mouth. And, you know, it make a lot of sense. They've worn for a long time getting like root canals and whatever, release all this bacteria that then cause like heart disease and things. Bad teeth can cause heart disease. Well, they're now seeing an even closer connection between bacteria in the mouth and disease itself, but it's not just in the mouth. You have a colony in your mouth. You have a colony on your skin. You have a colony, and I know, let's not get, this isn't being perverted, but there is a vaginal colony, and the reason why that is important is because right now they are doing studies looking at babies who were born naturally versus babies who were born C-section. And they've discovered that the babies who were born C-section do not have that vaginal bacterial colony on their skin. And they're trying to now discover what type of future physical illnesses could that cause because they did not have that proper colony. And one of the things that they're experimenting with is with babies. I saw there was someone else, another researcher, whose child was born C-section, and they were fully aware of the vaginal colony. And what they did was they took a swab and they swabbed the baby after a C-section birth to make sure that that bacteria was on the baby's skin. So this is something that right now, I mean, they know nothing about it. And right now this is in discovery as to what the differences are going to be between natural and C-section babies. And I'd be very interested in that. I was not able to have my daughter naturally. She was trying to come out ear first. And after 5 days of me almost being dead, they're like, oh, the baby's so strong. Yeah, well, the mother wasn't so strong. I was pretty done by the end there. You know, I definitely would be interested in those test results. So we have oral, we have skin bacteria, we have vaginal bacteria, we have gut bacteria, and we have the nasal / lung bacteria. Bacteria, and they are all separate colonies that interact and affect our different systems within our body every day without us ever knowing it. And our environmental factors and the things that we put into our body influence every single one of these, either to the positive or the negative. And that's why when you take things such as antibiotics and they wipe out your flora, it is just so dangerous because, especially like in the gut flora, there's that one disease. We've talked about that a couple times before. And I don't know if you'd even call it a disease. It's you wipe out all the good bacteria in your gut, and then the bad bacteria takes over, and you can get this C. difficile is what it's called. It comes in, and it will devastate your gut. You know, I had a couple friends who had that. And it could take, excuse me, a few years to get over square. I mean, you just cannot process any food properly in your intestines. And it can be pretty debilitating. But on the other hand, you know, there's research going into once a gut bacteria is devastated and you have something like C. difficile that sets in, how does that physically affect your other systems in your body, including your brain, with the direct connect between the brain and the gut? We saw that they had things such as poop transplants, right? We kind of laughed about that. And that is a real treatment now. But what is disturbing, we brought this up in the very beginning, if gut bacteria can influence your brain and your personalities, they've discovered, how is it going to affect you if you get somebody else's bacterial colony transplanted into you? Is it going to change your personality? And apparently it seems that it can. I don't know if I have that story queued up today, but we're going to look at that. Anyway, so I don't know. Reference dates established on June 13, 2012. A major milestone of the Human Microbiome Project was announced by the National Institute of Health Director Francis Collins. The announcement was accompanied with a series of coordinated articles published in Nature and several journals in the Public Library of Science on the same day by mapping the normal microbial makeup of healthy humans using genome sequencing techniques. The researchers have created a reference database and boundaries of normal microbial variation in humans. So that was as of 2012. They had the full database and they had the upper and lower limits of what is quote unquote normal to be able to now start doing experiments and seeing what people have. From 242 healthy U.S. volunteers, more than 5,000 samples were taken in tissue collections from 15 men and 18 women, body sites such as mouth, nose, skin, lower intestine, and vaginal. And all the DNA, human and microbial, were analyzed with DNA sequencing machines. The microbial genome data was then extracted by identifying the bacterial-specific ribosomal RNA. The researchers then calculated more than 10,000 microbial species that occupy the human ecosystem. We have 10,000 microbial species within our body that are all working together that our health is dependent upon. I mean, that's like them going out and deciding that, I don't know, soil bacteria is bad, and so let's dump Roundup everywhere and kill everything in the soil because it'll make it all better. It isn't, guys. We have an ecosystem. It's like saying that back in the 1800s that you got sick because, you know, the old woman looked at you sideways because there was no such thing as bacteria or viruses because we couldn't see them, right? Well, it ends up there's a lot more to what the eye can see. And we keep finding that over and over again. Never say never. So researchers calculated more than 10,000 microbial species that occupy the human ecosystem. And they have identified 81, which is 99% of the genera. And in addition to establishing the Human Microbiome Reference Database, the project has also discovered several surprises, which include, one, microbes contribute more genes responsible for human survival than genes of our own. And so we have genes of microbes in us. It is also estimated that bacterial protein-coded genes are 360 times more abundant than human genes. Number two, microbial metabolic activities, for example, the digestion of fats, are not always provided by the same bacterial species. The presence of activities seem to matter more. And number three, components of the human microbiome change over time, affected by the patient's disease state and medication. However, the microbiome eventually returns to its state of equilibrium, even though the composition of bacterial types has changed. And in that TED Talk, there was the one thing that he showed. They actually had a large projection of the five different microbial colonies on this baby mapped over a 2.5 year period, and they showed how they each evolved and how far away from each other and how back together they came with their interactions. And it was very interesting because when the kid got sick and they had to give the kid antibiotics, and you know, they try not to give children antibiotics unless it is very necessary. And I had always read under 2 is a time when you didn't want to do it. My sister, when she was a baby, ended up getting pneumonia. She had an upper respiratory and then got very sick, and they put her on antibiotics, and she ended up getting that stripy teeth, you know, where the teeth get striped. They're not white when they come in as adults. And they always blame that on antibiotic at a young age. Well, this researcher was saying that they also saw in real time that when this child in the study had to be put on antibiotics, it completely wiped out entire colonies just about of microbiota that then had to rebuild itself. And they said, wow, you know, they don't know what the implications are for future disease of wiping out these colonies at such a young age that then have to rebuild. But they definitely think that there is some sort of issue that they're going to find later in life. So anyway, let's hop on out here. There was a story that came out a few days ago, drinking coffee and wine, two things that you gotta love, are good for microbes in the gut. Well, phew, scientists have some great news for those who love coffee, tea, and wine. Drinking any of these beverages is associated with a healthy and more diverse community of microbes living in the gut. The opposite is true, of course, for consuming sugary drinks and whole milk, as well as for eating lots of carbs and indulging in frequent snacks, say researchers. So there you go. Sugar not only kills you in a lot of ways and makes your body more acidic, but it also screws with your gut microbiome. In other words, when it comes to the makeup of your gut microbiome, you are what you eat and you drink. In total, we found 60 dietary factors that influence diversity, but there is a good correlation between diversity and health. Greater the diversity of your bacteria is better. Your microbiome is the community of the mostly beneficial bacteria, fungi, and viruses that live on and in your body. And these microscopic organisms earn their keep by helping you process food and regulate your immune system. Experts believe that the makeup of a person's microbial community can also play a role in mood disorders, obesity, and other diseases, including irritable bowel syndrome. But the study of the microbiome is relatively new, and scientists are still working on exactly what a healthy microbiome looks at. To our knowledge, this is the first study to systematically assess such a broad range of host and environmental factors in relation to the gut microbes, and at such a large scale. They analyzed stool samples of 1,135 Dutch participants, and the participants collected their own samples at home and put them in the freezer. Oh, we didn't need to know that. TMI. No more than a few days later, the samples were transported to the lab, where they remained frozen until they were processed. In the situations where samples are sent by post at room temperature. Oh, I don't need to know that. Blah, 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 blah. We'll get down to the bottom. Some studies underscore that a healthy microbiome is a key component of healthy body, even if scientists are still working to understand how each one influences each other. But it's becoming more and more clear that the gut microbiome serves as a sort of fingerprint that captures all kinds of signals about the host health. And that's one thing that I was going to say, fingerprint. All of us have our own individualized microbiome that we have our own, and it changes over time, but your body works in harmony with these colonies of bacteria, and they said viruses and fungi as well, so I didn't know about that. Here, let's read a little bit more. Yeast infections linked to mental illness. Yes, they are. In a study prompted in part by suggestions from people with mental illness, John Hopkins research found that a history of candida yeast infection was more common in a group of men with schizophrenia or bipolar disorders than those without the disorders, and that women with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder who tested positive for candida performed worse on standard memory tests than women with schizophrenia or bipolar who never had a past infection. Researchers caution that their findings do not establish a cause and effect relationship yet between mental illness and yeast infections, but may support a more detailed examination into the role of lifestyle, immune system weaknesses, and gut-brain connections as contributing factors to the risk of psychiatric disorders and memory impairment. So, yeah, put on a seatbelt there. You know, and what worries me is as they're digging more and more into the microbiome and how it influences your brain, your moods, and your immune system, we have people like good old Bill Gates that are funding research for genetically modified foods that don't have any type of long-term research behind them. They're going out into the public market and people are consuming them. And are they studying what it is doing to our microbiome? So here we go. There was a story that came out in February that freaked me out because any kid who was this hard up and didn't realize what was going on, who did this, I really think we should be paying attention. The Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is paying students to eat GMO bananas for research. Researchers at the Iowa State University are moving forward with long-delayed project where a dozen students will be paid $900 to eat genetically modified bananas. The bananas were created by an Australian scientist and contain a gene that is supposed to help people living in Africa make vitamin A. The food science professor says the trial will take place sometime this year after approximately 2 years of being delayed. Activists, of course, have been signing petitions and delivering them to the university, saying that these foods have not been properly tested and there's been no animal testing of this banana. And this is the first ever GMO trial in feeding humans with hazardous experiments. Well, so they say, from eating genetically altered fruit. All right, guys, it's Friday, so make sure you stick around. Ms. Lonnie Clark is live up next, and we have Josh live at 6. Tonight, the guys from Primer Time at 8, Brandon, Alan Watt, and Anthony Media Love It. All right, guys, have an awesome weekend. I will catch up with you on Monday. Everyone, see you.